I wasn't really happy practicing law. And that's when I decided I needed to kind of somehow find a way out of practicing law and into more of what I enjoyed, which was the entertainment industry.
This is the Sparkcast, a bi-weekly show where we explore the creativity, technology, and business of CG. I'm your host, Marina Antunes. Rick Michel's journey took him from the electric buzz of Broadway in New York to the sunny embrace of South Florida. And now, as founder and CEO of Artist Animation Studio, to Kelowna, BC. His early days as a Club Med Kids Club counselor and a number of other unexpected roles laid the foundation for an extraordinary path through the entertainment realm, a journey that brought him to Vancouver for a tenure at Rainmaker Studios, where he faced the daunting challenge of steering the company away from the brink of disaster. He shares the bold decisions, the difficult layoffs, and the personal sacrifices made to keep the dream alive. It's a tale of resilience and leadership, where transparency and respect become the keystones of a remarkable recovery. Rick's career in the boardrooms of Technicolor and Sony Pictures Imageworks, and his pivotal role in the animation renaissance at Bardel, have all led to this latest challenge, the formation of Artist Animation Studio, where Rick looks forward to continuing a legacy of fostering a culture of creativity and innovation. Here is our conversation with Rick Michel. And I wanted to start by asking you about, growing up, because, you sort of adopted BC, or maybe BC adopted you. You've been here for, a number of years, but I expect you didn't grow up here. Can you talk a little bit about, your youth and where you grew up and what that was like?
Sure. Yeah, I had a great childhood. My parents were really interesting people. My dad was an entrepreneur. He was a restaurateur. He ran his own business his whole life. When he turned 50, he became a stockbroker. He left the restaurant business aside and changed careers at 50, which wasn't really done back then. And great guy. My mom was kind of a showman. She did plays in our local community and musicals, and she was really quite a personality. I started my first part of my childhood was in New York, Westbury, Long Island. I lived there till I was 10, kind of a typical suburban street, and a lot of friends and riding our bikes in the woods. And then when we were 10, we moved to South Florida, to Hollywood, Florida. And that's where I spent the rest of my childhood. And also a great place to grow up. We had the beach couple miles away, and a lot of kids in the neighborhood, and just a great kind of a place to grow up. So those were my formative years.
When did entertainment sort of enter your life as perhaps something that you might want to do down the road when you quote unquote grew up?
My mother's brother was involved in the entertainment industry, and he was kind of a idol of mine. I watched him. Also an entrepreneur, he started a very famous comedy club called The Improvisation, which spawned many, many comedians owe their start to the improv. And he was the founder of that. And so he lived a very kind of glamorous life. He opened in New York, then moved the club to Los Angeles. And we used to visit him, and I'd meet a lot of these comics that are famous now, like Jay Leno and Jerry Seinfeld, and the great Richard Lewis, who just died yesterday. But anyway, so that was one influence. My brother also decided to go to California, my older brother, and he went to UCLA Film School, and he was trying to get into the entertainment industry. So I had these touch points, and I loved movies growing up. I mean, I was just devoured movies on television, movies in theaters. I was a huge movie buff. And so that was kind of what led me to try and figure out a way I could kind of work in the entertainment industry. And even when I went to law school, I decided I would try for entertainment law because I thought that would kind of combine my interest in entertainment with, kind of my legal education.
So, I mean, when you go to law school, though, I mean, even if in the back of your mind you hope that you might find some way to go into entertainment, I'm assuming that that's not why you go to law school, though, right? I mean, what was it about law in particular that spoke to you?
I was always very academic. I loved school. And the law appealed to me just because I wanted to understand how society was run and organized. And, I thought it would be a great education. But I didn't really want to be a lawyer. I just kind of went into it because it was kind of a good pathway to other things, I thought. And as I said, I liked school and I did well academically. So it was kind of a way to kind of get something on my resume, something that I'd accomplished that I thought might lead me into other things. So that's why I went to law. When I found myself as a lawyer, even an entertainment lawyer, I wasn't really happy practicing law. And that's when I decided I needed to kind of somehow find a way out of practicing law and into more of what I enjoyed, which was the entertainment industry.
And how did that path sort of come about? Because you have some inter an interesting story of that first sort of like real in industry job at Live Entertainment, right?
My first industry job was at Live Entertainment. I was in acquisitions. The way I got that was really kind of a fluke. I had worked for another company and had some dealings with a guy named Paul Almond, who ended up running acquisitions at Live, and I knew him. And when I'd been a lawyer, I'd done some things with him. He remembered me. And so they had an opening for an acquisitions person to find kids programming because we had a big DVD label that needed content, and I had to go out and find the content. That was my job, acquisitions, right? Acquiring content. And so I interviewed with Paul, and then he had me meet the head of the company, Roger Burlidge, who really became a mentor to me. And Roger said, "What's your qualification here is, in terms of the kids space?" And I said, "Well, look, I was a lawyer. I worked for another little company. I'd done a lot of deals. I know how to kind of negotiate and understand distribution." I said, "But I worked as a Club Med GO in the kids club in Colorado. And every day I had to watch kids and understand how I was going to be able to keep them entertained and keep them interested. So I really feel like I have a knack for it. I know kind of what kids might respond to and what they want. I watched them watch programming and play games when I was their counselor." And he liked that answer and he hired me. He gave me a chance. And that was really my first break.
And I mean, that was kids entertainment something that like you were really passionate about, or was it just like
No.
an opera? It was just an was it, I guess it was just like an opportunity to kind of get your foot in the door.
Yeah, it was an opportunity to get into acquisitions, which is something I really thought would be great for me. You traveled to all the markets, and festivals, you looked for programming, you combined business and creative. And yeah, I mean, just that was the opening in kids. So I just said, "Okay, I'm going to go for it." I had no particular idea that that's where I would end up. And that's where I ended up. And the first, I think, second month of my employment, I was off to MIPCOM at MIPCOM in Cannes, France. And, I just got to know every company that produced animation and kids programming. And that's how I learned the business. Meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings. And I was a buyer, so everyone wanted to meet with me. So I was able to get good access to a lot of people. And that was it. I kind of learned that business, and I really came to like the kids' business more than the live action kind of traditional film business. I just liked the people. I liked it a lot. And eventually I was promoted over both all acquisitions. So I was buying the kids' stuff and the adult movies and things like that, the regular films. But I really always had a fondness for the kids' side.
So, it's your first sort of big job in entertainment. You're learning the ropes as you go. What kind of questions are you asking of these people that you're meeting? You're the buyer, so they want to meet with you, but you're also trying to learn the ins and outs of the industry. What kind of questions are you asking these folks that have maybe been doing this far longer than you have to kind of start to get an insight into, the business?
What I wanted to understand was how things were made, how things were produced, what kind of costs were involved in creating programming. Tell me about the process, I used to say. How did you create this? Where'd the idea come from? What choices did you make in your creative choices in terms of style and tone and look and why did you design the characters this way? Are there plans to make more? And what backs up this programming is, are there books or toys or other things that we can look at to help us distribute in the United States and Canada? And I was North American. I was buying mainly for North America. So it was all those kind of questions. I'm very curious. And so that curiosity really helped me. I talked people's ears off. They liked that I was interested in that. These people became my friends. So I got to know them so well that when they would create new programming, I would see it and they would make sure I got a look at it. And that's kind of what you want as an acquisitions person. You want to be able to see everything.
Yeah, you really became an ally that they could rely on, somebody that
Yeah.
was actually interested in what they were doing.
That's right. And there were all kinds of producers too. There were some that were just tiny little shops in France or UK or wherever, and some were big companies, Canal Plus and TF1 or whatever.
How did your experience at Live sort of lead into your next career role? Because they are very related.
Well, Live was sold like many companies. It became Artisan Entertainment and then it became Lionsgate Entertainment. So it was the predecessor to Lionsgate, but it got sold. The buyers had their own management team. So we left. And Roger Burledge, that guy who I mentioned as my mentor, he left as well. He was the CEO and he came to me and he said, "Look, someone has approached me with an opportunity to buy Harvey Entertainment, the company, Harvey Entertainment." And Harvey Entertainment, of course, was Harvey Comics, all those characters, Casper the Friendly Ghost, Richie Rich, Wendy the Witch, all these characters from 50 years of comic books were in this company. And Roger said, "You know the kids' business. I don't. Why don't we write the business plan together? And if we end up acquiring the company, I'll be the CEO and you'd be the president." And it was a great opportunity. It was a public company, a NASDAQ company, and we actually competed against Artisan Entertainment, who had bought Live to buy Harvey. And we ended up getting the deal and buying Harvey Entertainment and taking over that company. And Roger really gave me that opportunity to be president of a public company. And he and I ran that company. And we had a business plan to exploit those characters in all kinds of media, DVD and television and licensing. We were a global licensing company, we had licensing agents all over the world. handling our characters, and it was one of those great opportunities from a great mentor.
Did that also give you the chance to delve more into the sort of the creative side of things now that you're actually like you have these characters and it's your job to make them into things?
Yes. I mean, everything then was, I wanted to make sure, because, preserving the integrity of those characters is what the value of that company is. So I looked at everything and made sure I was involved in every creative meeting, read every script, gave notes, basically like an exec producer role on everything that got made. I had great executives that executed, but I was involved in all of that.
What led you to leave that role at Harvey and sort of move on to your next adventure?
Well, the company got sold again. We got approached by two buyers. One was Classic Media, which eventually got bought by DreamWorks, and the other was a German company, RTV. Classic Media ended up acquiring us and merging the Harvey Library and all our programming into their company. So there was no need for us. We were redundant at that point. And so one of my vendors, Mainframe Entertainment in Vancouver, was looking for a CEO. Their shareholders found me and interviewed me. Their shareholders included IMAX and a couple other shareholders. And they recruited me to move to Vancouver and become the CEO of Mainframe, which, by the way, was also a public company. That was my second public company that I ran, this time as CEO. And we had hired Mainframe to do our Casper, the Friendly Ghost DVD video. So I knew the company, I knew the people there. And that kind of got me to Canada. That was my first visit to Canada, 2002. And that's when I moved to Canada, knowing one or two people at most in Vancouver. And here I was with a company that was in somewhat dire financial straits and needed kind of a turnaround. I was crazy enough to think that with the help of a good, solid executive team, we could turn the company around, and we did.
But I mean, when you took that position, you didn't know what you were sort of walking into, did you?
I mean, if I had, I might not have taken the position. But when I got there and I looked at the financials and what work was there and what revenue was, it was really dire straits. I mean, we were 6 months away from having to declare bankruptcy. And so I had to act immediately. That job really challenged all of my skill sets and instincts. And you may have heard me say this before, but I was always a student of history. In my academics, I loved history, and I remembered Franklin Roosevelt taking on presidency of the United States during the Depression. And when he came in there, he knew that he had to act immediately. There could be no time for passing laws or anything. So in the first 100 days, he instituted all these policies. Well, that's how I saw it. I said, okay, I have 100 days to do everything I can to try and bring this, right the ship. And then I can bring in work, because I had enough relationships to bring work in. So, we unfortunately had to lay off a third of our workforce immediately. There was no work for them. And they were just kind of there, sitting there. Now, I met with every single person that we laid off, and I said, listen, I hope to bring you back. And a lot of those people we did bring back once we started getting more work in. So we did those layoffs. We did across the board salary cut. I just had ideas, including my own salary. I thought, well, this is how I'm going to kind of turn the tide. And eventually we started getting work in. Our costs went down. We were able to kind of turn the company around and attract actually an investor that, put a like a $15 million valuation on the company at that point. So that was a real success story for me and my team. They were great people that I worked with there. We had a great, real solid team effort.
Two things that come out of that experience. And the first that strikes me is the fact that you met with everyone that you let go, which is something that you kind of hear about in some instances, but never at a company the size of Rainmaker, where you're letting go 100 people, a third of your workforce. Why
Yeah.
was it important for you to, to have those face-to-face interactions with these people that, you've only been there a short time and all of a sudden you're telling them, I'm sorry, there's no work for you today?
I've always believed this again is from my father, right? It goes back to your first question. Watching my father run his restaurants and then as a stockbroker, how he dealt with his clients. Transparency, communication, respect for people. Those are kind of my watchwords. And so when you do a layoff like that, every person deserves to be heard and told the truth about why they're being laid off. It's not because of you, it's because we don't have the work and we have to cut costs, so the entire company will fall. So I just felt it was important that they knew that out of respect.
And I think the key word there is transparency, because that's part of that other question that I was going to ask about this fact that, you sat with everyone, the entire company, and you laid out the facts. You didn't, dilly-dally around it. You're like, this is the situation. We need to make some like important and key changes in order to move forward. And one of those is taking a salary cut, because that's a hard thing to say to people. Right. But you were very transparent about the whole process, which I assume also helps to build like a camaraderie and sort of like a family where everyone knows exactly where they stand and you're all working towards the same goal.
That's right. I mean, we had a town hall meeting where I laid out the financials for the company. We were a public company anyway, but I laid it all out. I said, here it is. This is why we're heading towards closure if we don't take drastic action. And that was it. I had no one kind of protested because we were all in the same boat. They saw I was taking a cut as well. And so, once they had the information, they understood that the company's survival was dependent on this.
How did that sort of change? I'm assuming that also had an impact in, in the studio itself, walking through the floor and seeing this change from the ground up. I assume that, there was also, amongst the artists, probably a sort of a feeling of perhaps like hope that that this was going to actually come out okay at the other end.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that people were hopeful and felt like things were finally being done, realistic things. The company had had a history of separation between senior management and kind of everyone else. And so this was more, like, okay, we're all in the same boat. And we're gonna pull it out. It was kind of, we were like underdogs, and it was kind of a that feeling. I remember on the floor, people were really hopeful that these things were gonna change the course of the company, and they did.
Can you talk a little bit about that? So you go in to this floundering company on the verge of bankruptcy. You're there a few years, you right the ship, and all of a sudden you're sold again.
Yeah, I mean it was, I mean it was almost 5 years. And I always say that that experience, nothing matches that experience of going into a company that's on the verge of disaster and kind of, riding the ship. That's for me was an incredible satisfaction to doing that. But yeah, I mean, this is kind of commerce. And again, we had a buyer who wanted to get into the animation industry. They were a visual effects house, and it was good for the shareholders and good for everyone. And so the deal happened, and that's just the way it goes. It was okay. By then, I was jaded enough to understand that, this is kind of the corporate system, things get bought and sold, and on to your next opportunity.
So now that you're jaded, Rick, your next opportunity, you take a big leap. You go into video games of all things.
I saw a niche for kind of a company that would do outsource work as a vendor for large game companies. I knew that these companies needed inexpensive vendors to do basic modeling or animation for kind of all these growing platforms at the time, like the DS platform. And I also was kind of ahead of my time because we had a remote workforce. We did it with artists who were working out of their homes. Modelers, animators. We had our little office in Yale Town, but in Vancouver, but most of our artists were remote. And we had a network of people. It was me and two other people, and we kind of managed all these projects as, as a vendor. And it was fun. I mean, we had a good time doing it. We tried to kind of build our own games. We didn't get that far because eventually I got recruited for an opportunity that I didn't want to turn down. But it was a good couple of years in the game space, just providing that service. We were a pure service company. Yeah, we had a good experience. Again, good team of people, and that remote workflow thing really worked for that model, the simple kind of things. I remember we worked on the Hello Kitty game for Nintendo, and we did a lot of fun things. I got to know the game space more, which I liked. But then, and kind of that led to my next opportunity. Because I'd now done animation and some games work, Technicolor approached me to run their animation and games unit out of Los Angeles. So now I was going back to LA with Technicolor. And now I was running animation, and we did a lot of cinematics and some games work for clients too. So it was just a really good opportunity to being with this company that was doing great work, a lot of Nickelodeon work and animation. We had a studio in India that I was in charge of. We had about 40 artists, 50 artists in Burbank, California, and then hundreds of artists in India at our studio there. So, and we had a joint venture with DreamWorks Animation. So I was managing that joint venture with DreamWorks. So it was too good an opportunity to pass up.
Going back to this concept of Reach Games, where you were working with a team that was almost entirely remotely, and now at Technicolor, you're in a position where you have these teams that you're basically managing remotely. Like you have all of these studios in various places that are all
That's right.
working, and you're overseeing all of them. So you really were kind of like tailored for this position.
Yeah, I was a good fit for sure. A friend of mine, Santa Schwartz, is the one that recommended me to the Technicolor people, and they called me, and it was kind of an easy fit. Not many people had had the experience of I had done work overseas too with vendors when I was at Mainframe, so I knew the overseas studio model, I knew the domestic studio model, and like you said, I knew remote workers, although these were all concentrated in studios at Technicolor, but it I was a good fit, and it was a good experience. I enjoyed it. The company has struggled a bit recently, and they but I look fondly on those people I worked with, and still am in touch with a lot of people from my team at Technicolor. One of them's at DreamWorks Animation, one of them's at Amazon. The people that worked under me, and great crew of people, and yeah, I it was we did a lot of great work. I missed Vancouver. Sony came calling, and again, another amazing opportunity after 4 years at Technicolor to go back to Vancouver and start from scratch, from zero, the Sony ImageWorks studio, which just was we built to be the largest animation and visual effects studio in North America. I'd say that, that again challenged my skill set, my instincts, because we were starting from zero. I was the first employee. And I made the label that you put on the mailbox, on my label maker. I mean, it was that kind of thing. And we started in Yale Town. We kept getting bigger and bigger. And I had a great boss, another great boss, a mentor, Randy Lake, who's now the COO of DreamWorks Animation. He was great boss, and Bob Osher was his boss, and he was, another guy that I was a great mentor to me, and they supported really building our studio in Vancouver at the time that we came in. There weren't really that many outside studios that had built studios in Vancouver. We were one of the first. It was 2010, the Olympics, when we opened. And, we kind of led the way, us and that. There was a Pixar studio too, but we were the two kind of opened the door to Vancouver and kind of created this huge critical mass of very large studios now in Vancouver. But again, great experience. Lucky to have a great team who I am in touch with all around the city. And we eventually, we're up to 800 people. Started with 60, really, initial crew of 60 working on the first Smurfs movie. And of course, worked on Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, Hotel Transylvania, Spider-Verse. All these great movies came through the studio. Just a great experience. I personal reasons wanted to go back to LA, and Bob Osher, who had been one of my bosses, gave me the opportunity to start producing television at Sony Pictures Animation, based on those movies. I said I identified this opportunity where I felt we should be making these series. Just like DreamWorks was doing. And Bob gave me the opportunity to come back to LA and set up a little unit to produce these television series. So I stayed with Sony. I'm still associated with Sony since 2010. So it's been, 14 years with Sony. I'm still associated with Sony. I'm still producing an open season TV series, still continuing that. Same plan that proposed, way back when.
SPI was really one of the first to kind of identify Vancouver as a place to go. What was it about the city, do you think, that Sony saw and that you saw as a good opportunity and ripe for, a studio?
I knew the talent base here. Remember I had run Mainframe and the games side, and so I knew that there was really great talent. Talent that could step up to work on these big features, because that was something that had not been done in Vancouver before, the big theatrical animated features. And I knew that the talent that I'd worked with at Mainframe and other studios around town could step up and do that, maybe with some mentorship from senior talent in LA, but not, that the talent base was here. And then, there was, of course, the tax credits. Sony was feeling, the budgetary pinch. They wanted to create their movies for less money. So the tax credits helped versus LA. And the time zone, of course, being in the same time zone as LA. And the proximity, it's 2.5 hour flight. It wasn't a crazy distance for people to go back and forth, because we still had a huge group at ImageWorks in LA, so we were connected. We were the satellite studio. Eventually they became the satellite studio, but initially we were the satellite. So people would come up and go back, and directors would come up. And so the proximity and the talent, and the tax credits, really, that was, those were the three big factors. I had faith that we could create the work at the same level as in LA.
It was a good bet.
It was a good bet. Yeah, it's still going strong. Michelle Grady, my friend, is running it now, and she's my successor, and she's, it's a fantastic studio.
You mentioned a little bit of working back on the creative side of things with SBA. You're doing that, you're still doing that. How does Bardell come to be a part of the conversation? Because I get the
Well,
sense that, you like the creative space. So, what was it about this job at Bardell that kind of piqued your interest?
that's a weird thing about me. I do like challenges. And, after 4 or 5 years, I tend to think to myself, it'd be interesting to kind of take on another challenge. I guess I get a little, not bored, but I get a little, I don't know what's the word, a little set in the ways there. So I want to inject some change in my life. Bardell came to me because they were in need of some change and some turnaround, not to the same extent as Mainframe, but they had kind of work had been mixed in terms of staying with clients staying with them. There was some production management troubles. There was a little bit of financial pressure on the company. And this Italian company, Rainbow, had bought Bardell 2 years earlier. And, I think they wanted to make a change, and the founders were ready to step away. And so they came to me and they said, would you look at the company and write a report for us as a consultant on what you think is, the good, the bad, the ugly? And I spent a month talking to everyone at Bardell and interviewing everyone. I wrote this 25-page report, and I identified where I thought the problems were and how to fix them. And they liked that the report, and they said, well, would you come and be the CEO? So I thought about it, and I went to Sony and I said, look, I want to keep producing these shows, but we're done with Cloudy the Chance of Meatballs. We're almost done with Hotel Transylvania. Open Season will be next. How about if I continue as a, outside producer to run these shows, and you keep me part of Sony, and I take this job as CEO of Bardell for 3 or 4 years to kind of turn this studio around? And Sony said, okay. They said, yeah, we want you to keep doing this. And Rainbow, the Italian company who owned Bardell, also said okay, because they said, well, it's good for you to stay associated with Sony. Maybe they'll be a customer, And so I was able to come to Bardell, keep my Sony position going in a different way as a non-exclusive, outside producer. And Bardell was another challenge, Again, a young team of management folks who I think needed to be empowered and needed to kind of recognize that leadership was supporting them and not working against them. And off we went. We started by focusing on what we did best, which was soup to nuts television, high-end televisions. Because first thing I did when I got there is, okay, what's our mission? What is our agreed upon mission for this company that we all want to get behind? And that mission was not to do 16 little bits and pieces of shows, but to do soup to nuts of five quality, high-end quality, high-end television shows. We didn't want to compete with the factories around the world. We didn't want to do the low-end, stuff. We said our expertise is high-end animation for television, soup to nuts, pre-production through post-production and delivery. That's what we can do for you. And that's what we went out and we spread that message loud and clear. This is who we are. This is what we want to do. And that's what we did. We had Dragon Prince, very high-end show for Netflix. We did Super Kitties for Disney and Silvergate, a high-end preschool show. We started doing work for Disney Plus and Fox, this Diary of a Wimpy Kid, these featurettes for Disney Plus, 65-minute movies, Ice Age movie for Disney Plus. So we started doing these higher-end IPs, intellectual properties, bigger budgets with our pipeline focused on these kind of soup to nuts shows, and it worked.
Empowerment seems to be something like a theme that comes across through all of the opportunities that you've had over the course of your career, and allowing people to giving them an opportunity to find their voice and to sort of lift themselves, and in the process lift everything up with them. Was that something that was natural to you from early on in your career, or is that something that you've learned over the course of your 30 plus years in the industry?
I learned it from watching my mentors and how they managed, I saw how they got the best out of people. And it was by empowering them and by supporting them positively, not negative reinforcement, positive reinforcement. And I have a tendency that I have to watch to be a micromanager. So I have to consciously remind myself to not micromanage. But deep down, I had this belief in empowerment, and if you hire good people and you let them do their job, you'll succeed. And so that's what I believe. My instinct sometimes goes against that, and I have to kind of consciously work on that. And I think we all have things like that that we kind of want to, improve upon. And that's my learning edge, don't micromanage. Let people make mistakes. And I had good mentors, that's really how it happened. I learned from good people. I didn't know it, I learned it.
And how important is that to you? You have the experience of having had these individuals in your life that have helped you move on in your career. How important is it for you to, keep the door open for other folks to come to you and ask you questions and learn from you?
I think it's one of the most important things anyone with experience can do. People write me, and I always am open to, I can't always answer and spend time with them right away, but I'll always say, I'm happy to give you any advice. Just, I can't do it for another couple of weeks, but check in with me in a few weeks. Or, I always write back to people within a day or two. I think it's very important. Again, that respect thing. People write you write them back. And so yeah, I'm always happy to give back. I think it's important because I had good people with me, and so that's a big part of my day. I always kind of answer people's notes, and I mean, there's a few people I could count on my hand who are in very, very senior roles in our industry. When you write them, they write you back within a day or two. And I always admire those people because I know how busy they are. And I think that's the way everyone should be in an ideal world, But not everyone's like that. But for me, that's a really important thing.
You clearly don't just sit back and think, okay, well, I'm done now. I'm just going to take a break and, retire. I mean, you could have. I mean, I think it's there are certain points in your career where you could have just sat back and said, okay, I'm done. I've done enough. But you don't. You take another giant leap forward.
I know. Well, first, let me say, with Bardell, it's never, these things are never like a straight line. Like we had many ups and downs in the 4 years, And so by the time The fourth year came around, we were in good shape. And I felt like, okay, it's time for these people who work, the younger management team to kind of take it on. And that's what I recommended to Rainbow. I stayed another year as kind of a mentor, but they didn't really need me. They knew what they were doing, Tina Chow and Richard Grieve running the company now, and they're great. And I was kind of, I'm still doing my Sony thing all these years. I'm still producing, but I thought, I'm kind of bored. And I know I just wasn't ready to kind of just do my Sony thing and sit back and, I don't know. I call me crazy, but I wanted a challenge. I started looking at studios that maybe we could roll up into a big studio. And I had these private equity guys I was working with, and we were looking at different studios to put together, which I thought was a good plan. And we couldn't get those studios to kind of sell at the right valuation, and they didn't want to sell for whatever reason. And then this opportunity came along in Kelowna. I have a second home in Naramata in the Okanagan, and I know the region. Ashley Ramsey had worked for me at Mainframe. She and her husband, Todd Ramsey, were the founders of Yeti Farm. I knew Kelowna because Bardell has a studio there. I'd spent a lot of time there. I knew the advantages of Kelowna. It's kind of like, Vancouver 20 years ago in terms of the talent base and schools. It's all kind of fresh and new, developing. And Ashley and Todd, were kind of ready to step away. There was some issues they wanted to deal with, and I came in and was able to make a deal that where I finally got to own this studio that I'm running. So I now own former Yeti Farm is now called Artists Animation Studio. That's a new name, which now you've heard this whole podcast, artists are very important to me. That's why I named it Artists Animation Studio, AAS. It just was an opportunity, and I felt like I had a vision and a mission in myself, what I could do with this studio, and that was kind of to bring the quality even higher on their 2D work, stay focused on 2D, which is what they do really well. There's plenty of CG studios out there, and build the talent base in Kelowna. Todd Ramsey, thankfully, stayed with me as head of animation, co-founder of Yeti. He's aboard as part of my team. I got a great supervising producer from Titmouse, a guy named Dan Christman, who's terrific. So we got great production management, a great senior producer named Rachel Beppel, also from Titmouse, who had been at Yeti before that. So really strong production management, great creative. And we really want to build this thing into a real 2D competitor to some of the bigger studios. And I guess I'm crazy. I just wanted to kind of work harder. What could I say? You'll have to interview me in a couple of years, see if it worked out.
So you talk about this drive to challenge yourself and to try new things and your passion for learning and for wanting to be a creative person and to give back to the community. How do you keep that drive like alive? Because I mean it's easy to get like bogged down by the day-to-day and by the hits that that really like grind you down. It's easy to kind of give up and just say, you know what, I'm done. I'm stepping away. How do you stay motivated and keep that creative energy going?
Having a good team of people gets you excited every day. We have a couple times a week, we all get on a call and wherever I am, and we kind of go through agenda. And I like all that. It gets me excited. It gives me energy. So that's one thing, the people you're working with. And I think the mission, a mission to accomplish certain goals. I'm goal-oriented. So I like that. I like waking up every day and having something to push me forward. The goal of succeeding and turning, kind of creating something that eventually, we may sell or merge or something where you've created something of real strong value. That's all these things inspire me. Yes, there's a lot of day-to-day stuff that can get you down, but and it gets me down, sure, but overall, these other things kind of compensate for that and push me ahead. And that's kind of how I keep moving forward. And I just like it. I like our industry. I like the people in our industry. I just went to Kidscreen, to the Kidscreen conference. I really enjoyed it, seeing everyone. It's fulfilling to me. And I guess that spirit of entrepreneurship, you started this by asking me about my childhood. My dad, was a real entrepreneur, and I think he inspired me. He didn't just kick back at 50, he changed careers. That was a big deal back then, So I kind of want to follow in his footsteps.
You've gone through, over the course of your career in the industry, you've seen a lot of ups and downs, and a lot of hard times, and have, worked through a lot of difficult situations. What are some insights that you can provide for folks that are might be struggling right now, on how they can sort of, stay motivated and sort of work through this hard time until, we get back into the saddle and back into the swing of things?
It's a tough time for sure. The last year has been really tough on a lot of people. I don't know what I could say it's going to make people feel better other than it's cyclical. I see signs of rejuvenation and resurgence now in our industry, right? It's March 1, 2024. I see signs of resurgence. I see demand picking up. Adult animation shows are getting commissioned. Studios are starting to commission more work. Keep your head down, cut costs where you can. This period of time eventually will be a time you'll look back on and take satisfaction out of surviving. And survival is success now. And remember that. Don't beat yourself up. We're all in the same boat. And you just got to charge forward and know that the time's gonna it's gonna get better. It is. Canada is a great center of creative excellence and animation excellence, and it is gonna get better. There'll always be a demand for quality. Quality will always win out.
And that was our conversation with Rick Michel. You can find out more about Rick's latest venture, Artists Animation Studio, at their website at artistsanimation.com. The Sparkcast is a production of the Spark Computer Graphics Society. Opening and closing credits by Michael Edlund. Editing and additional production support by Joshua Peterman. For more about Spark CG and our upcoming events, visit sparkcg.org.